So far we've looked at spiritual growth and spiritual awakening. I want to briefly examine three more spiritual experiences. The first of these I call actualization. Actualization is an experience arising from the relationship that exists between the person that you are today and the person that you would like to become at some point in the future. To better appreciate the nature of actualization, let's take a closer look at the nature of understanding. I argued earlier that the core ingredient of any relationship is understanding. But what is the core ingredient of understanding? I believe that core ingredient is reduction. Reduction is the breaking down of some complex system into less complex component parts and principles. Understanding results only after we become aware of these component parts and principles and the way they function together to give rise to the complex system. It's not unlike building a puzzle. To complete a puzzle, you must have all the pieces, and the pieces need to be arranged in a particular way. So you need both the pieces and the arrangement of the pieces in order to complete the puzzle. Missing pieces will result in a partial understanding. Pieces that have been forced into places that they don't belong will result in a mistaken understanding. Can you see that? Think back to our earlier example about the complex mathematical formula. The mathematician understands the formula because he understands each of the symbols in the formula, as well as the way that the symbols combine to produce the formula. Understanding is rooted in reduction. I don't believe there are any exceptions to this. Recall how my personal connection to my evolutionary past really came alive for me when I imagined that connection in terms of individual photographs arranged in chronological order. You see, that's reductionist thinking. Even your relationship with your mother can ultimately be reduced to individual experiences that took place in a certain sequence in time. And prior to that very first experience, there was no relationship. Reduction plays a central role in any relationship, and the spiritual experience that I call actualization is no exception. Let's think of how this works. There is a gap that separates the person that you are today from the person that you would like to become. Now, you can bridge that gap in your mind by reducing it to individual activities, individual steps that, if taken, will inevitably result in your becoming that ideal you. Can you see how this works? Once you grasp these individual steps, this person that you want to become, in a sense, becomes more real to you. At that point, there is something for you to have a relationship with. This person that you imagine yourself becoming is no longer just some blind wish that you place in the hands of God and hope will someday magically fall out of the sky. You can now see, you can now understand that you can actually become this person if you will simply take the steps down the path that leads to that person. And think of this. With every step you take down that path, you are doing more than simply crossing off an item on a to-do list. You are experiencing yourself actually becoming that person. This is the experience of actualization. While actualization is the experience of becoming this person you desire to become, it's also the realization that this process actually works. It's the realization that reduction works. And with this realization comes an expectation. Specifically, the expectation that if you will reduce some long-term goal to short-term steps, and then take those steps, you will achieve your goal. This is not magic. This is reality. Religion, on the other hand, relies way too much on faith and prayer and God. God, please help me pass this test. What kind of expectation is in that? What kind of confidence is in that? If you can't grasp the individual steps that lead to the person that you want to become, or if you aren't willing to take those steps, then that person that you want to become will remain forever locked away in the closet of your imagination. Your relationship with that ideal version of yourself will be weak at best and will likely be the source of more frustration than inspiration. A fourth spiritual experience that I want to share with you briefly is what I call legacy. Like all spiritual experiences, legacy is the product of a relationship. But this is a relationship that transcends our present time. Sir Isaac Newton once said, "If I see farther than others, it is only because I stand on the shoulders of giants." Today, we stand on Newton's shoulders, and Einstein's shoulders, and Washington's shoulders, as well as the shoulders of countless nameless others who did something with their lives that affected our own lives for the better. That was their legacy to us. What will your legacy be to future generations? Do you even feel a kinship to the future? Does that relationship even exist for you? Or do you find yourself isolated in the present? If you do find yourself isolated in the present, I would ask you to think once again of my imaginary stack of photographs. Only this time, try to imagine what the pictures will look like in the future. 10 generations from now, 100 generations, 1,000 generations into the future. What will the faces in the pictures look like? Will they be smiling? Will they be happy? Will they be healthy? Will there even be any photographs? Like it or not, and whether we're even aware of it or not, each of us is going to leave a legacy that will touch the lives of the people in these pictures. Maybe they won't even know our names, but our deeds today will produce effects that they will have to live with, for better or for worse. If we truly value our relationship with these future generations, we will want our deeds to leave a positive mark. One last experience I want to share with you is something I call spiritual liberation. One word that comes up over and over again as I talk to people who have let go of a religious tradition and struck out on their own is this word, liberation. They feel liberated, like they've been released from some kind of cage. They feel free to explore reality and to arrive at their own conclusions. Now, there's nothing in this term liberation that implies a particular belief. A person can liberate oneself from a religious tradition yet still very much believe in God. In fact, it's almost fashionable today for people, when asked about their religious beliefs, to say something like, "Well, I'm not really religious, but I am spiritual." You see, it's like they've drawn a distinction between the two. I think this is a very positive movement. Spiritual liberation is about understanding that your mind is free to think whatever you want, is free to believe whatever you want. Many religions in the world today, especially the big monotheistic religions of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have attempted to enslave people's minds. They do this by threatening death, condemnation, and torture to those who dare to embrace unorthodox beliefs. Now, if you think the words death, condemnation, and torture are too strong, then I would ask you to consider the following examples of death, condemnation, and torture. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, Moses threatens his followers with death if they dare to promote the worship of any god other than the God of Israel. Verse 6 reads, and I quote, "If your very own brother, or your son or daughter, or the wife you love, secretly entices you, saying, 'Let us go and worship other gods,' do not yield to him or listen to him. Show him no pity. You must certainly put him to death. Your hand must be the first in putting him to death." Unquote. Jesus, the so-called Prince of Peace, threatens condemnation on all those who refuse to believe in him. In Mark 16, verse 16, Jesus tells his followers, quote, "Go into all the world and preach the good news to all creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whosoever does not believe will be condemned." End of quote. And in the Quran, in Surah 4, verse 59, we find this jewel, quote, "Those who disbelieve our signs we will in the end cast into the fire. So oft as their skins shall be well burnt, we will change them for fresh skins, that they may taste the torment." Unquote. Death, condemnation, and torture. Is it any wonder that these people have been murdering each other for thousands of years? The experience of liberation is the exhilaration one feels as he gives these monotheistic maniacs the proverbial middle finger and strikes out on his own. It's really an act of defiance. like cutting eye holes in your burqa or eating a Big Mac and fries on Lenin's tomb. Spiritual liberation is about rescuing your mind from the ecclesiastical terrorists and thinking whatever it is you want. Related to this notion of liberation is our attitude towards a critical treatment of ideas and beliefs. Those of you familiar with some of my other work know that I tend to be pretty critical when it comes to many orthodox religious beliefs. But that's because I think that they are largely untrue, often absurd, and at times patently immoral. But as critical as I may be when it comes to these ideas, I will never condemn a fellow human being for simply embracing these ideas. You see, there's a big difference between criticizing the idea and condemning the man. This important distinction is lost in many circles today. And this is unfortunate, because a healthy critique of ideas is the fuel of civilization and intellectual advance. Too often, when somebody criticizes a person's religious beliefs, it is seen as uncivilized. When people say that about me, I just ignore it. And I ignore it for two reasons. First of all, I am not condemning the person who holds the belief. And second, a free and open discussion of ideas, even a critical discussion of ideas, is the necessary foundation of any free society. Now, there's a time and place for this criticism. If I'm invited to somebody's Christmas party, I'm not going to get up on the coffee table and start bashing Jesus. I mean, that really would be rude and probably wouldn't help my cause any. Honest criticism can be quite healthy. Condemnation, on the other hand, can be pure poison. Ironically, many of those who recoil in shock at the very hint of criticism very often think nothing of embracing, defending, and even promoting beliefs that condemn many of their fellow human beings to an eternity of fiery torture. There's something very wrong with this picture. Yet it's a picture we see everywhere in our society. You will never know the feeling of spiritual liberation if you are not willing to be critical of ideas. Criticizing an idea is not a mean thing. It's just part of an honest search for the truth. Look, when somebody tells you that 2 plus 2 equals 5, it's not a mean thing to say that you think they're wrong. What's mean is telling somebody that if they refuse to believe that 2 plus 2 equals 5, that you will douse them with gasoline and set them on fire. That's mean. Before continuing on, it might be a good idea to take just a minute and define this word that I've been throwing around for the last hour or so. The word, of course, is atheism. Atheism, in the strictest sense of the word, means without a belief in God. Nothing more, nothing less. When I tell you that I am an atheist, I've told you only what I do not believe. I've told you nothing about what I do believe. This is important to keep in mind, because in the popular imagination, the word atheism calls to mind all sorts of ugly, horrible things that have nothing to do with atheism. Things like communism, reckless amorality, genocide, even devil worship. None of these nefarious activities has any causal link with atheism. Be that as it may, shameless fundamentalists, eager to capitalize on a prejudice that they helped to create, blame atheism for everything from school shootings to the AIDS virus. On the flip side, many atheists would like for you to think that atheism is synonymous with rational thinking, scientific inquiry, a concern for the environment, world peace, women's rights, animal rights, children's education, to name just a few. Well, this is nonsense. I can be an atheist and be just as out of touch with reality as a Shenandoah snake handler tripping on LSD. Look, atheism means one thing and one thing alone: without a belief in God. Now, if this is indeed the case, and it is the case, then why atheism? What is the advantage of living one's spiritual life in an atheistic context? Let me share with you three reasons. First, atheism does not burden you with the obligation of having to accommodate a presumption of God. To illustrate, let's pretend that I am a cartographer by trade, a map maker. My boss gives me the assignment to create a map of a particular town, a town that I've never been to before. I know nothing about this town. However, prior to my starting the job, my boss tells me that in the middle of this town is a great big amusement park. And he tells me to make sure that I include this amusement park in the map. So when I get to the town, I arrive with an expectation. An expectation that there is an amusement park in the middle of town. There's just one little problem. When I get to the town, I can't find an amusement park anywhere. So I call my boss and I tell him my problem. And he tells me, "You aren't looking hard enough. Try harder. The amusement park is there." And he hangs up. So I look again. And I do try harder this time, but still no luck. So I call my boss again. And this time he says, "Earl, you've got a bad attitude. You'll see it when you believe it. Now go find that amusement park." And he hangs up. So I try again. And again with no success. When I call my boss back the third time, he's really upset now. And he threatens to fire me if I don't have that map on his desk by the end of the week. And there had better be an amusement park in the middle of it. Now at this point, I don't know what to think. I'm confused. I'm scared. I could lose my job. And I start doing weird things. I walk into a 7-Eleven, and I see an ice cream cone for sale, and I think to myself, here is an ice cream cone. Wait a minute. They sell ice cream cones in amusement parks. Maybe this is part of the amusement park. I'm racking my brain trying to force my experience of this town into my expectation of this town, and I'm not having any luck. This is very frustrating. Imagine how less frustrating my job would be if I could just forget about this amusement park and simply create the map based upon the territory in front of me. And imagine, too, how much better the map would be. Growing up, I was taught that God has revealed truth to human beings and that we human beings are obliged to incorporate this revealed truth into how we understand reality. When some of us complain that this revealed truth appears to have no foundation in reality, what are we told? Well, we're told that we aren't trying hard enough, or that we have a bad attitude. We're told that we need to just believe, to just have faith. Very often we're threatened. We're told that if we refuse to embrace this revealed truth, that God will fire us. And not fire us in the employment sense, but really fire us in hell. My present atheism is a result of my having let go of what I perceived to be conflict. My religious beliefs had created expectations about reality that clashed with my experience of reality. That's what I mean by conflict. Letting go of those old beliefs not only put an end to this conflict, but it freed me up to seek out new beliefs consistent with my experience. Beliefs that resonated with reality rather than clashed with it. This doesn't mean that I now possess a complete and perfect understanding of the universe. Rest assured, I don't. There are many things about which I am completely ignorant. But ignorance is not the same thing as conflict. Ignorance is the experience of trying to find your way through Chicago without a map. Conflict is the experience of trying to find your way through Chicago using a map of Detroit. I'll take ignorance over conflict any day of the week. For me, spiritual growth is about building a relationship with reality that is free of conflict. Atheism allows me the luxury of doing that. My second reason for framing my beliefs in an atheistic context has to do with morality. As an atheist, my most valuable relationships in life are those that I have with people. Accordingly, my entire system of morality is rooted in a value for people. Back in my religious days, things were different. People were not at the top of the value food chain. God was at the top. As a consequence, my religious morality was rooted in a value for God, not a value for people. I'm reminded of the story in Genesis where God commands Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. Abraham's willingness to follow God's commands, even to the point of butchering his own child, is portrayed by the religious world as one of the greatest displays of human righteousness ever. I think there is something very, very wrong with this attitude. And this attitude is not confined to the pages of Scripture. There are people in the world today who would sooner see their children go without food and clothing before they would stop giving money to their church. There are people in the world who would sooner watch their children bleed to death than take them to a doctor and admit that the prayers were not doing the job. I think there's something grossly immoral in all of this. But that's because I value people more than I value God. But then, I believe in people, and I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. My third reason for framing spirituality in an atheistic context has to do with the very concept of God itself. I've been arguing that spirituality is that dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with reality. I've also argued that all relationships are a function of understanding, and that all understanding is a function of reduction. It's this process of reduction, so crucial to all human understanding, that raises what I believe are insurmountable problems for the concept of God. And that's because the very concept of God itself is anti-reductionist. To illustrate, let's pretend that Stephen Hawking gets his wish and that someday we do indeed discover a scientific theory of everything. Let's also pretend that our theory of everything enables us to understand everything in the universe as a function of five fundamental things. Five brute facts. Five categories of raw materials and or principles that are able to account for everything we observe and experience. These five categories represent the rock-bottom givens of reality. How would the concept of God fit into such an understanding? Some will argue that God is the creator of the five categories. In fact, the very existence of the five categories necessitates the existence of a creator to account for their existence. God is that creator. Now, at first glance, this argument may appear reasonable, but a closer look reveals several problems. For starters, isn't it entirely possible that these five categories were not created at all, but have always existed? I mean, you got to start somewhere. Why not these five categories? Suggesting that the five categories were created necessarily implies that at some point, the five categories did not exist. Can you see that? This puts us in the awkward position of having to defend the existence of something that does not exist. Or put another way, it puts us in the position of defending the existence of nothing. And as Robert Ingersoll once remarked, nothing, when considered as a raw material, is a most decided failure. Here's another problem. Because God is an entity distinct from the five categories that comprise our universe, we're talking about something that is totally beyond our capacity to experience, since everything we experience is in the universe. As a consequence, all claims concerning the nature and existence of this alleged God are nothing more than speculations about the inconceivable. Such a thing hardly seems worth dying for, much less killing for. Perhaps the biggest problem we run into is this. We have the universe on one hand, and we have God on the other. The universe is reduced to five simple categories. This reduction is the source of our understanding of the universe. God, on the other hand, is not reduced. God is necessarily complex. In fact, God is extremely complex. God thinks and plans. He creates and destroys. God does stuff and is stuff. God, I've been told by some people, even has a sense of humor. I find that a little hard to believe after September 11th, but the point here is that whatever else God might be, God is complex. Now here's our problem. We are attempting to understand something that is simple, our five categories, in terms of something that is complex, God. We're explaining the simple in terms of the complex. Reduction works in exactly the opposite direction. Reduction explains the complex in terms of the simple. The bottom line is this. Positing the existence of a God to explain the existence of the universe is anti-reductionist. And because it is anti-reductionist, it is anti-understanding. Be that as it may, this doesn't stop believers, and even many sophisticated apologists, from asserting that their belief in God helps them to make sense out of the universe. Listen to me here. A belief in God cannot make sense out of the universe. Using God to make sense out of the universe is like using angels to make sense out of airplanes. God does not make sense out of things. God makes nonsense out of things. And that's because God is a non-reductionist concept. I'm reminded of a verse in the Quran that says, God says, be, and it is. In other words, God just snaps his fingers and stuff magically pops into existence. Now, how does that help a person to make sense out of the universe? It doesn't. It can't. Thinking that God makes sense of the universe is like buying a TV set at Sears and thinking that you got the thing for free because you used your credit card. Well, of course you didn't get the thing for free. Eventually, you're going to have to fork over the cash. All the credit card does is push back the settlement date. In a similar way, using God to explain the universe doesn't explain anything. It simply pushes all the unanswered questions we have about the universe back a step, and then declares the questions answered by God. It simply sweeps them under the rug. This is not a good thing. Just like not paying your credit card bill is not a good thing. It gives the illusion that these questions have been answered when in fact they haven't been answered. It gives the illusion that we have attained ultimate understanding when in fact we have not. Even worse, religious zealots, now armed with this pretended understanding, feel justified and even obligated to impose their nonsense on the rest of us. And when we refuse to believe, they shift into high gear and begin spewing threats of hell and torture and eternal agony. Sometimes these threats spill over into this world. This is where things get ugly. This is when witches are burned and heretics are tortured and jumbo jets are intentionally flown into buildings. And how about the casualties of the intellect? The casualties of understanding? Like refusing to even entertain the ideas of Darwin simply because they don't agree with some ancient myth. Or like imprisoning Galileo because the ideas he championed, which turned out to be true, posed a threat to so-called revealed wisdom. Imagine for a moment that we could turn the clock back 1,000 years and somehow siphon off a mere 10% of the time and money and sweat and brain power that has been invested in the defense and promotion and worship of this pretended understanding, and then funnel those resources into some more rational pursuit. How many more diseases would be cured? How many more useful inventions would we have at our disposal? How many more instruments of science would we have to explore the universe? How much more would we understand? It's almost too depressing to even think about. Atheism is the absence of a belief in God. Atheism is not the perfect map. Atheism is not a system of morality. Atheism is not true understanding. Instead, atheism is a framework within which these worthy ideals may be pursued and realized. I like to think of atheism as a sort of intellectual construction site, one cleared of the debris of theological presumption. It's on this site that we can build our understanding of reality, an understanding built on the firm foundation of reality itself. That is the value of the atheistic context.